In chapter 6 of the book of Deuteronomy, we begin, or Moses rather, begins an exposition of the first commandment. So in chapter 5, as we saw last week, he gave the Ten Commandments. And now he's going to begin through from chapter 6 to about chapter 26 to expand upon the Ten Commandments and to indicate to Israel how these commandments are to be thought through and lived out in their lives. So he's thinking particularly about this commandment: you shall have no other gods before me. You shall have no other gods before me. This is the commandment that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, Moses says to them. It's a command for the heart. It's a command for the heart. They're to take it to heart. They're to take it seriously. It's a command that is to affect their heart. It is a command that calls upon them to love the Lord their God with all their heart and with all their soul and with all their might. And Jesus would add, and with all their mind. Now, we're not to try and decipher those individual words and try to understand, well, what does it mean distinctly to love God with all my soul, and what is it to distinctly love him with all of my mind, and what is it to love him with all of my strength as distinct from loving him with all of my heart? Now, these are terms that are intended to show us that our love for God is to encompass the whole of who we are. It's about me as me loving God as he is. Not in part, but the whole. And particularly in the language of the Bible, the heart being the spring of life, as Proverbs 4:23 puts it, as well as another number of other verses, to love God with our hearts is to have a love for God that encompasses all of our life. It's a wholehearted devotion to God, we might say. It's not simply talking about an emotional attachment to God. That's not what this is about. It's not about having a feeling of love, an emotion of love for God, but rather it's about a life that is devoted to God in all of its being, in heart and mind and soul and strength. The whole of who I am is to be devoted to God. So the reality of God's existence and the reality of God's person and work in this world is to affect me, so that it draws from me a devotion to him in the way that I think and the way that I behave, in the things that I hold dear, the priorities that I have in my life, the use of my time and my resources. These are all part of the way that I will show my love for God, my devotion to God. He is to have the preeminent place in my life. Above all others, he is to come first. This is what he says when he commands that we should have no other gods before him, ahead of him, having a greater place than him. Not that there are any other gods, you understand, but we tend to make gods, don't we? We make gods out of all sorts of things. We think about the idols. We think about the totem poles. We think about the Asherah poles. We think about the Baals. We think about the golden calf. We think about carved gods and intricate designs that people bow down to and worship as God. But while we may not have those things, we nevertheless make gods of other things. We may make our employment, our job, our God. We live for that. We might make our family our God. We live for that. We might make some hobby or other our God. It becomes our obsession. Our thoughts dwell upon it every spare moment, and we can't wait until the next opportunity that we have to devote our time to it. And it takes the place of the one true and living God in our life. And we begin to worship this or that or the other thing in the place of God. God doesn't take possession of our hearts like those things do. God doesn't take possession of our time like those things do, or of our thoughts like those things do. We become obsessed with those things rather than being obsessed with God and his greatness and his goodness and our obligation to him as his creatures, to honour him, to serve him, to worship him, to devote our lives to him. So this is a command for the heart, by which I mean it's a command for the whole of our lives, that God is to take possession of us, as it were, to own us, and that should be evident in the way that we use our time, in the way that we prioritize him in our lives, in our choices, in the decisions that we make, in the time that we spend with him in prayer and in reading his word and in worshipping him with his people. So this command to love God with all of our heart, our soul, our strength, is a command to devote our lives to God, to honouring him and serving him. That's the first thing that I want you to see from this greatest of all commandments, as it's entitled here, and as Jesus referred to it, and as others have done also. The greatest commandment, to love God with all that we are. But the second thing I want you to see in this passage is that this command for the heart comes from the Lord our God. It comes from the Lord our God. The Lord your God commanded me, says Moses, to teach you these things. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. These aren't simply Moses' ideas, Moses' thoughts. These are the words that God has given him to communicate to Israel as a nation. He is the Lord their God. Who is this God? Well, he's the God who presents himself as the creator of the heavens and the earth. That's how he presented himself at Mount Sinai when he gave the Ten Commandments to the previous generation of Israelites. He presented to himself as the one who created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested from all his work that he had done, and his pattern of work and rest was to become the pattern of work and rest for his people. He's the creator. And as the creator, then they have some obligation to him that he has made them. He has given them life and breath. But he also has presented himself to them as their deliverer. And that's how he presents himself in this book of Deuteronomy to the second generation of Israelites as they are encamped in the plains of Moab. In the very same commandment, as we've observed a number of times, where he calls on them to keep the Sabbath day, this time it's because it is a day of rest from their slavery. He has delivered them out of Egypt, delivered them from that manual labor in the slave camps of Egypt. And he's brought them out into the freedom of his service, that they might worship him, that they might serve him, that they might devote their lives now to him as their deliverer, rather than devoting their lives, although unwillingly, to the Egyptians as their taskmasters. Jesus calls upon people to come to him and to take up his yoke, because his burden is light in comparison to the slavery of sin. He delivers us into a service that is pleasing and enjoyable, and even, we might say, restful. And so there is a deliverer who has brought them out of this slavery and freed them to serve him. This is the Lord your God, who has delivered you, who has brought you out, and who calls you now to love him with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your strength, to devote yourselves to him. He is the Lord your God. But more than that, he is the God who has made promises and showed himself to be faithful. He is the God of their fathers. That's the very common description of God, isn't it, in the Old Testament? The God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. Well, how is that significant? They worshipped him, they loved him, they served him. And so, well, they must maintain the tradition, and they too must love him and worship him and serve him. No, it's saying far more than that. It's saying far more than simply this is their heritage, this is the background that they've come from. Like a Muslim might say, well, my father was a Muslim and my grandfather was a Muslim, so I'm a Muslim. Or a Hindu might say, well, for generations my family have been Hindus. And you might say, well, for generations my family's been Christian, so I'm a Christian. Now, there's more going on here in the statement, I am the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. He is the God who has called them to be his own people. He is the God who has been faithful to his promises. He is the God who has delivered them. He is the God who is bringing them into their possession. Therefore, they must love him with all their heart and soul and strength. It's not just a tradition. It's not just family values being passed from generation to generation. He has a call on them, and they are bound to him. He is the Lord their God. And furthermore, he is the only God. That is what it means when it says, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. We could say he is the only one. Now I acknowledge, and the footnote in the ESV demonstrates, that there's various ways of translating that statement. But in essence it is saying, there is only one God. There is only one God. Certainly that's how the man who spoke to Jesus understood it. There is only one God. There is no other God. So if you determine that you are not going to love this God, you're not going to devote yourself, your life, your being to this God, who are you? What are you going to devote yourself to? Well, whatever it is, this statement is saying it is no God at all. It is no God at all. We read this morning in our service from Isaiah chapter 40. And in that chapter it talks about people making gods, making idols. But they are not gods. They cannot move. They cannot do anything. You can pray to them, but they do not hear. They cannot answer. They cannot deliver. They cannot help you. There is only one God. There is one creator. There is one deliverer. There is one being that has a claim upon us. And that is this God. The God of Israel. The God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. There is only one God. And God, through Moses, tells the Israelites that they must love him and him alone. They must devote themselves to him and him alone. And furthermore, that they must command their children and their children's children to love him and him alone. And they must be committed to growing in their knowledge of him and reminding themselves about him and his existence, because he is the only God. And so he says, you shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Well, some of the Jews took that quite literally, and they have little boxes that they strap to their hands and to their foreheads with texts from this scripture in them. And they have boxes on the doorposts of their homes and apparently even of their cars and hotel rooms. They've taken this quite literally. But of course it's a figurative thing, that the reality of God and who he is and of his call upon us should be constantly before us, ever before us, and not only ever before us, but also ever before our children. I was reading just in the last couple of days a little article about someone who was religious. She was actually a Roman Catholic, and she had been brought up as a Roman Catholic, but had determined that she wouldn't bring up her children as Roman Catholics, that once they were old enough, they can choose whether they would be or not. She didn't want to indoctrinate them. She didn't want to influence them. It was something that they should have a free choice over when they were old enough to have a free choice about it. But that's not what God says. That's not what the one true and living God says. That's what the world says. The world says, don't indoctrinate your children. Well, they would, wouldn't they? Because they don't believe in this God. They don't submit to this God. They don't honour this God as God. But God himself tells us, teach them diligently. Mould them. Shape them. According to my commandments. Now, it is true that they may choose to go their own way later. And that is a price that they must pay of rebellion against God. But our duty as parents, as grandparents, is to ensure that our children and our children's children know this God, know that he is the only God, know that they are duty bound to love and serve this God, and there is no other. There is nowhere else to go. There's nowhere else to turn, no one else to serve. He is the preeminent one. And we must teach them and present God to them as the only one and the preeminent one, and that they have a duty to love him with all that they are, as we have a duty to love him with all that we are. This isn't some optional proposition that they can feel free to reject. This is something that they are commanded to obey by the living God, and rebellion against it will bring his condemnation for eternity. But the third thing that I want to say this evening is that this command is given that it might go well with them. That it might go well with them. Hear therefore, O Israel, be careful to do them, that it might go well with you. Life apart from God is destined for destruction. Life apart from God is destined for destruction. that it might go well with you, honour this God. Love this God. Serve this God. Give your life in devotion to this God. Now, there were very real physical realities to this promise for the Israelites. That it may go well with you, that you may multiply greatly as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. There were very real, tangible evidences of God's love and care for them if they loved and served him. And they could forfeit his love and care by their failure to love and serve. And that actually is exactly what happened to Israel, isn't it? It became a divided nation. Many of the tribes were totally destroyed, and others went into captivity because of their failure to love and serve the God who gave them these wonderful promises that it might go well with you. But we need to always remember that their fathers, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and others who shared their faith, understood that this promise ran far deeper than the physical, tangible realities around them in the promised land. And the writer of Hebrews makes that very clear, and it does us good to keep reminding ourselves that they weren't looking for a physical fulfillment of this promise. By faith, Abraham went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. The writer goes on to say, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. They were looking for a city whose foundations and whose designer and builder was God. And the writer of Hebrews tells us they received it. God prepared for them that city. And it wasn't in Palestine. It wasn't across the Jordan in the land of Canaan. It was a heavenly city. When God says that it might go well with you, he wasn't simply thinking of physical abundance, a land flowing with milk and honey, but he was thinking of eternity, which is what the promised land typified. That it might go well with them, not just for time, but for eternity. They had their difficulties, they had their battles, they had their skirmishes throughout their history. But those who were loyal to God knew that God was faithful to his promises. Abraham, a foreigner in the land that his descendants would inherit, understood that reality. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, cast into a fiery furnace in a land of captivity, understood the promise of God and had faith in God. Their friend Daniel, who was thrown into a lion's den, knew the reality of God's promise. Job also understood it. And many others also in the history of the Bible and in the history of this world have understood that the promises of God are true and trustworthy. And we are to love and to serve this God because he is true and trustworthy. And when he says, it will go well with you, we can devote our lives to him in the midst of calamity, in the midst of suffering, in the midst of things falling apart all around us, because we know he is preparing for us a place where there will be no more pain, no more sorrow, where he will wipe away every tear and there will be eternal joy and peace for us. And this is the reality of the call to love him and to serve him with all of our being. A command for our hearts from the Lord our God, that it might go well with us. But there's more that we can say in conclusion. How do we love this God? How can we give him our hearts, our lives? Well, the scriptures tell us we can love him because he's first loved us. And he demonstrated his love for us in that in the midst of our rebellion against him, in the midst of our self-centered lives, he came to provide deliverance from sin and from its consequences. You see, Israel failed, didn't they? Israel failed. God called them as a nation, and it's interesting that he turns from the plural to the singular in the midst of this passage, speaking to them as individual Israelites and then turning to speak to them as a nation and saying to the nation, you are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength. But they didn't. They couldn't. They failed. They rebelled. They went away. They served other gods who are not gods, rather than serving and loving the one and only God. Where Israel failed, how can we succeed? We have hearts like theirs, hearts that are prone to wander and to leave the God we love. Hearts that are enticed by the world all around us. Hearts that are set upon the physical and the tangible realities and that lose sight by faith of the things that are eternal. And we have a tendency to focus upon this life and the things of this life rather than on God and the things of the life that are to come. But where Israel failed, Christ has prevailed. He is the true Israel, and it is all those who are united by faith in him who can love God with all of their heart, soul, mind and strength. It is not because we are somehow different from these Israelites whose history we know. We're not any different from them. Our hearts are as fickle as their hearts. Our moods as changeable as their moods. Our loyalties as shallow as their loyalties, apart from the grace of God at work within us, changing us from within through the power of the Spirit of Christ. And so this promise then that it might go well with us, this is, in the end isn't achieved, doesn't become ours because of who we are and what we do. It becomes ours because of what Christ has done. Because he has been loyal to God. Because he has loved God with all his heart, soul, mind and strength. Because he devoted himself to the service of God and only did the Father's will and went to the cross in order to accomplish the Father's purposes. And it is only through faith in him then that we can take possession of these promises and make them our own. We say heaven is ours because of Christ. And he has given us the down payment of the Spirit in our hearts. It is the guarantee that we will take full possession of the promise in due course. But until then, let us make this command our own. to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our might. For He is God alone.